prices at the same time. Do you think that this strategy will work this time as it did in the 60s?
No. And the primary reason for that is because Saudi and the UAE are almost completely depleted when it comes to their oil reserves. When Biden spoke with Saudi at the Jeddah conference this past weekend, Mohammed bin Salman said that he could not up the production capacity to 13 million barrels per day until 2027, I believe he said, and that Saudi would have to continue putting out about 10 million barrels per day as it currently is. And that is a complete lie on the part of Saudi. They don't have the capacity at this point to be putting out 10 million barrels per day. In fact, if you look at the history of Saudi oil production going all the way back until 1973 and tracing it up until this very day, they produced on average a little over 8 million barrels per day. And even at pressure times when they were essentially forced to increase their output, they could only ramp it up to 11 million barrels per day and sustain that for about 2 months or so. And what proves this, in addition, is that Saudi has been buying oil. It's been importing oil from Egypt. This is Russian oil that Egypt is buying and then exporting to Saudi. Saudi has also been importing oil from Kuwait and Iraq, and of course, looting oil from Yemen. This is the primary reason, if not the primary reason, then one of several primary reasons why Saudi has been waging its genocidal war on Yemen.
There's another American goal of this visit, which is to try and reformulate, if I may, the map of the balance of power from the American axis in the region of West Asia, so that Israel is the center of gravity, pushing for what the West calls the Middle East Strategic Alliance, MESA, which we've spoken about recently on this show, otherwise known as the Arab NATO. How realistic is that alliance at a time when Biden clearly said that the U.S. is actually seeking a diplomatic solution with the Islamic Republic of Iran to end this row about the nuclear program?
I don't think it's realistic at all. In fact, the foreign minister of Saudi said that essentially Saudi has no interest in joining a Middle East NATO or an Arab NATO. The King of Jordan expressed interest a little while back, but in totality, it seems like none of these countries, the GCC countries and the plus countries involved in that council, really want to join such what would be an offensive alliance against a resistance axis that has clearly grown stronger since the last time it was put to the test in a big way, which was in 2006 in Lebanon, when Hezbollah very decisively beat the Zionist occupation entity that calls itself Israel. It's gotten stronger. Hezbollah has, Ansarullah has, the Iranian resistance has, the entire resistance axis has gotten stronger in the past 15, 16 plus years. And the U.S. and its vassal states in Arabia have no interest in going to war with them. So I think that this idea of a Middle East NATO is dead upon arrival. It won't get any traction. And really, it's just putting a new name on what has always been this sort of talk about normalization is really just putting a new name on what has always been. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have always had a relationship with one another for at least 50 years. And the same could be said for the UAE. We're seeing Morocco become more public with its relationship with Tel Aviv, but these relationships have always been there. And to ramp that up into some kind of offensive coalition a la NATO, does not seem a reality to
but
me.
But we are still hearing Israel pressing to put a military solution on Biden's table against the Islamic Republic of Iran. But Biden has given Israel, the U.S., not only the Biden administration, many military, political, and economic tools to confront the Islamic Republic of Iran by itself, and they were not able to do that. But the real question is, added to that, obviously, the laser intercept system and the joint regional air defense system as well that are being put in place that we saw them showcasing when Biden arrived in occupied Yaffa, which is known as Tel Aviv. But the real question here is, will the U.S., if it is pushed to such a raw with the Islamic Republic of Iran, be able to handle another front blowing up besides the Russian-Ukrainian one already there?
No, absolutely not. The U.S. and Western Empire, the larger Western Empire, including the UK and the EU, is already pushed to the limit with its war capacity. The weapons deliverables on the part of the UK and Canada, for example, are totally kaput. They have no more to give. They're trying to increase their production to give more. The US is trying to give more and force its NATO allies to give more, but the production capacity, much like the production capacity for Saudi and the UAE vis-a-vis oil, just isn't there. On top of that, there's inflation going through the roof throughout Western Empire. It's at 9.1% in the US right now, which is a conservative number. And the funds, the production capacity, they're just not there. And the US has no clear game plan for what it's doing in Ukraine, other than just funneling money and weapons incessantly into the country. Mm-hmm. So were another front to arise in West Asia, I do not think, despite what the U.S. has provided the Zionist occupation entity, that it would be able to last for very long.
Well, I want to thank you very much from London, Jesse Zerowell, writer, editor, researcher, and also a producer and host at TNT Radio for joining us to discuss this vital issue for the entire West Asian region. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Biden is towing the Israeli line in West Asia.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
So last week, the U.S. President Joe Biden was on his first visit to West Asia since taking office early last year. His first stop was obviously Israel. His visit was met with protests by Palestinians demanding justice for the murder of martyr journalist Shirin Abu Akleh at the hands of Israeli occupation forces. Neither this issue nor the larger issue of the continuing violation of Palestinian human rights by the Israeli apartheid regime featured in Biden's agenda. More details in this following report.
U.S. President Joe Biden preempted his meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas by confirming that he would continue the approach of his predecessors in providing absolute support to Israel, crowning it with the so-called Jerusalem Declaration and his emphasis on his Zionism, even if he is not Jewish. This stance blocked any soft positions that could have been issued by the Palestinian factions, which kept their hopes high for the possibility of reviving the negotiating track and even maybe the U.S.'s call for a two-state solution. Over the course of 2 days, the cities of the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip witnessed demonstrations condemning Biden's visit, while the resistance factions organized a protest condemning the Jerusalem Declaration and the absolute American bias towards the occupying entity, in conjunction with another demonstration that roamed the city of Ramallah at the invitation of the People's Alliance for Change, in which political leaders and representatives of the factions participated, declaring their rejection of the policy of economic peace that comes at the expense of the political rights of the Palestinian people, in exchange for an improvement in services and the disbursement of some money. On the level of political positions, the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhale, considered that the results of Biden's visit to the region are known in advance to the Palestinian people, as it seeks to secure the interests of the United States and the security of the Zionist enemy. Nakhale stressed in a press statement that as a Palestinian people and resistance, we must learn lessons and stop building dreams on such a political movement. As long as we do not create a serious problem for the enemy, then all political analysis and all statements are of no value. The leader of the Jihad, Muhammad al-Hindi, in turn said that mentioning the resistance in Palestine and Lebanon in the so-called Jerusalem Declaration confirms in one aspect the effectiveness, influence, and presence of the resistance factions, which have become insurmountable in any regional arrangements. In the same context, Hamas indicated in a press statement that the Jerusalem Declaration demonstrated Washington's approach to side with the occupying state and supporting its aggression against our Palestinian people and their Islamic and Christian lands and sanctities, adding that it comes in continuation of the suspicious American administration's attempt to liquidate the Palestinian cause. Observers believe that the most prominent repercussion of the American visit, apart from political influences, is what the Israeli security establishment will obtain from support for some of its weapons that have not yet matured in a practical manner. The review of systems such as the Iron Dome, the laser system, and David's sling in Biden's reception ceremony confirms that completing the development of these weapons through partnership in supporting their project is one of the priorities of the visit from Israel's point of view, because most recent confrontations with the resistance factions in the region have proved that Israel is not ready to handle the fire of the resistance.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Brussels is Yuri Smouter, journalist and producer and host of 1+1 show on YouTube. Thank you very much for being with us, Yuri. It's a pleasure having you on board. Now, Biden is trying to re-engineer West Asia as per the American vision to allow maybe the integration of the Zionist entity into West Asia and to legitimize its existence without solving the pressing issues of the occupation, colonialism, and they are presenting Israel, the Americans are presenting Israel as if it's the entity that is the leader in security, in military, in compensation for the decline of the American presence and hegemony in West Asia, and specifically with the current conflict between the U.S., China, and Russia. But is this what the so-called Jerusalem Declaration about, or do you think there's more to that declaration that is undeclared?
First off, thank you for having me on. And yeah, I think to answer your question, I believe it's a bit of both. I think the U.S. is trying to scratch Israel's back by saying, hey, we continue to stand with you despite all of Israel's crimes against humanity. America is, the American Anglo-American Empire is still, committed to Israel and the Zionist project. And I think at the same time, while the U.S. and its allies are doing the pivot to Asia, which is preparing for a possible war with China as well as NATO expansion, Israel, which often if you look at history, Israel is often a partner in crime to the Anglo-American Empire. So I believe this is also, the U.S. saying to Israel, "Hey, we still stand with you. So we will continue to overlook your crimes against humanity towards the Palestinians." And the Jerusalem Declaration explicitly also is committed to a possible war with Iran. So both Biden and the new Prime Minister of Israel, Lapid, have both said that they are committed to, a a war against Iran if Iran is building any nuclear weapons, as well as confronting Iran for its supposed proxies in Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria and elsewhere.
Well, but Yuri, Biden does not have any practical political vision to resolve anything in Palestine. Even according to the American policy adopted for decades, which is based on the two-state solution and the rejection of annexation and settlement, illegal settlement building in Palestinian-occupied territories. Rather, we see that the current U.S. administration has adopted the same vision that former President Donald Trump has actually wrote in the so-called deal of the century. Do you think that Biden will be able to buy off the some sort of a Palestinian calm in return for a courtesy visit to Mahmoud Abbas, empty political promises, maybe some dollars that he threw in?
Yeah, it's, you know, it is quite remarkable because, Biden is not going to move he's not going to close the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. There's no pressuring or even finger wagging at Israel diplomatically to stop its ongoing illegal settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And then at the same time, it seems as if Biden, is more or less continuing the reactionary policies of Donald Trump while still bizarrely propping up the two-state delusion. Will he be able to buy off the Palestinians with dollars? He's definitely not buying off the Palestinian diaspora or even the Palestinian civil societies within Gaza and the West Bank and Jerusalem because by now all of them are committed to the democratic one-state solution. They're committed to trying to end the occupation peacefully with BDS, and so I don't think that Biden's going to be able to buy off the Palestinian leadership, although he might be able to buy off Fatah by showering them with, you know, semi-NGOs, with development aid, and, you know, saying to them, hey, we continue to recognize you as the only legitimate Palestinian voice while continuing to support the monstrous genocidal embargo on Gaza. So I think that's what's going to happen, is that they will continue to buy off Fatah, but in terms of grassroots Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian diaspora and its allies, no, they're done with the empty promises of a two-state solution for all the reasons I just mentioned.
While just backing up any Israeli aggression against Gaza, which is the biggest open-air prison on earth, and saying nothing about the genocidal, the incremental genocide that is being applied against the people of Gaza who are native Palestinians. But Yuri, mentioning the resistance in Palestine and in Lebanon inside that piece of paper that was signed, the so-called Jerusalem Declaration, it confirms in one of its aspects maybe the effectiveness and the influence and the presence of this resistance in West Asia, which have become undefeatable in any regional arrangements. We've seen that. This is not just talk. If this means anything, it simply, for me, it hints a failure for the Zionist occupation in the face of the continuous, literally, rejection and the continuous struggle of our people and of our region and of our resistance forces. Do you think that Israel is capable of fighting off this rejection when everything else so far has failed?
That's a very good question. I think for the reasons you just mentioned, it does show the resilience of both the Palestinian and the Lebanese people, that despite, you know, this, you know, despite this decades-long occupation of the occupied territories, despite ongoing monstrous sanctions, despite Israel and the U.S. essentially buying off the Gulf states to say to the Palestinians that, hey, your land is over, your idea of nationhood is over, and you just have to accept whatever the Israelis do to you, come what may. So I think it does show the resilience of the Palestinians and the Lebanese, but the problem is that without international efforts and without international efforts to end the occupation and to say, look, the two-state solution is over. It's the one-state solution, the one democratic state solution, and but I think because of that, because of the resistance that you just mentioned, that's why Israel and the U.S. is stepping up its efforts at pushing the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which essentially closes any legitimate criticisms of Israel. And of course, there's, you know, from Canada to Britain, the U.S., there still is ongoing efforts to silence Palestinian solidarity on the college campuses. And as we saw, you know, 2 years ago with the Jeremy Corbyn leadership, demolished in Britain, there still is that effective smear campaign that anytime you criticize Israel legitimately, they still throw the anti-Semitism smear campaign on you. Mm-hmm. So I think as a tribute to the Palestinian resistance, the Lebanese resistance, I think we in the West, we just need to step up our efforts and say, not in our name, BDS now, mm-hmm. Democratic One State Solution now.
And maybe tell the people that Arabs are actually Semites. They cannot be anti-Semites because they are Semites. I want to thank you very much, Yuri Smouter, journalist and producer and host of 1+1 show on YouTube. Thank you very much, Yuri, for being with us on the Mideast stream. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week because we have boiling news coming from our region, and you find it right here on the Mideast stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The price for shameful behavior must go to Guterres, who has proven himself to be no defender of children, says Ali Abu Nima, journalist, in an article published under the heading UN Chief Greenlights Israeli Regime's Killing of Palestinian Kids. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Israel is one of the world's worst violators of children's rights, according to Antonio Guterres. But the UN Secretary General has once again left the Zionist regime off an annual list, naming the world's worst abusers. By doing so, he's sending a clear message to Tel Aviv that it can continue killing Palestinian children with impunity. This isn't the first time the UN chief has singled the Zionist regime out for special treatment, but it once again highlights the complicity of international bodies in crimes that they are supposed to work to prevent. Guterres reported that Israeli security forces killed 78 Palestinian children and injured 982 in 2021, more casualties than caused by any other armed force or group in the 21st conflict countries covered in his review, Human Rights Watch observed recently. Despite this, Guterres failed to include Israeli forces in his annual list of shame for violations against children in armed conflict, the group added. Human Rights Watch said, for years, Guterres has employed a double standard by listing some parties on his list of shame while omitting others that have often committed far more violations. Israel has never appeared on the list, even though the UN has found its forces responsible for killing or injuring more than 7,000 Palestinian children since 2015. In his 2022 report to the Security Council on Children and Armed Conflict, Guterres states that the highest numbers of grave violations were verified in Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the occupied Palestinian territories, Somalia, and Yemen. State and non-state actors in each and every one of those countries, along with many others, are on Guterres' list, but none from the Zionist regime. The 15 countries from which state and non-state actors are named in the list of shame are all in the Global South, 8 of them in Africa. In Yemen, Guterres once again omitting Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and their American and European allies, whose devastating 7-year war on that country has caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with particularly severe harm to children. Similarly, in Afghanistan, the UN omits mention of US and allied forces whose invasion and 20-year occupation of the country cost the lives of tens of thousands of children, even as American occupation forces withdrew chaotically from Afghanistan last summer, leaving behind a devastated country on the brink of famine. The U.S. carried out a drone strike that killed 7 children. In 2015, Ban Ki-moon, Guterres' predecessor as UN Secretary General, caved in to pressure from the Zionist regime and the United States and removed the Israeli regime army from an initial draft of the list. In doing so, Ban rejected a recommendation from his own special representative on children and armed conflict and numerous human rights organizations and child rights defenders. That abject cowardice in the face of political pressure set a precedent that has been observed ever since. This year's report covering 2021 does not, however, ignore the situation of children living under Israeli regime rule. Indeed, Guterres states that the UN verified grave violations against 1,208 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank, including East al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, and the occupied territories. The report paints a horrifying picture of systematic Israeli regime violence against Palestinian children, including the detention of more than 600. Guterres notes that the Zionist regime's 11-day bombing campaign against Gaza in May 2021 resulted in a significant increase in the number of cases of violence against Palestinian children. Almost 70 Palestinian children were killed during the Israeli regime attack. So far this year, we have not witnessed a similar number of violations, Guterres asserts, adding, however, should the situation repeat itself in 2022 without meaningful improvement, Israel should be listed. With this shocking statement, Guterres appears to be telling the Zionist regime that the horrifying violence it inflicts and has inflicted on Palestinian children day after day for decades after decades is an acceptable baseline. It is in effect a UN green light for the fake regime of Israel to kill, maim, and jail Palestinian children, but just not too many. Guterres asserts, meanwhile, that the Israeli regime is engaging with the UN to prevent any more violations against children and adopt clear and time-bound commitments. This charade allows the Zionist regime to continue its crimes under cover of an endless process based on the lie that its military occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism, an apparatus designed for persecution, can simultaneously respect the rights of its victims. So far this year, the Zionist regime occupation forces have killed 16 Palestinian children, and as usual, no one has been held accountable. This is because the only way to end the Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinian children is to end its brutal rule over them. And, in another attempt to obscure the Zionist regime's responsibility and introduce balance where none exist, Guterres threatens to add Palestinian resistance organizations to his list of shame. But the price for shameful behavior must go to Guterres, who has proven himself to be no defender of children.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
With 43 years on file, Iran's Constitutional Council has witnessed countless elections to supervise and volumes of legislation to vet. Its anniversary of July the 17th is an excuse to take a trip in time to see what it saw through the eyes of its own members. It's a question of why a Constitutional Council or upper legislative house then, what its importance is today, and how it's kept honest to its task. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, and our show guests here on Iran Today. On all to do with the council, we got to hear it from its very spokesperson, Dr. Tahan. That was at the Constitutional Council Research Center, where we did another couple of interviews too. Let's start with the birthday and why it had to be.
Well, the notion that the laws ratified in the country should not be in violation of Sharia standards, I can say it has been a long time concern in our country and amongst our people. After all, the people of Iran are a Muslim nation, and for years their concern was that Islam is observed in the country. Maybe if we go back a little further, when the first constitution, which was the Persian Constitution of 1906, was ratified, this subject was brought up for the first time. After the ratification of the Constitution, after a year when its amendment was approved with the efforts of dear figures such as Sheikh Fazullah Nouri, this notion was added in the amendment.
The word constitution is a reminder of Iran's constitutional revolution, which took place between 1905 and 1911. That revolution largely failed, leaving the nation with a more or less traditional monarchy rather than a constitutional monarchy, be it in modern times with less barbaric means of suppression. Mr. Kanani Moghaddam may be an outsider to the council, but he is no outsider to matters of state since the revolution, when he was not yet 20, but active all the same.
To what extent would you say the failure of the constitutional revolution had to do with founding a constitutional council all those years later?
Well, the experience of the constitutional movement and the deviance from the principles of the constitutional movement reveal that there is a need for a master key to preserve the nature of the Islamic system. Considering that the constitution would hold the monarchy to account to observe both the law and Islamic Sharia, but who would supervise such a thing? And because of this lack of supervision, the constitution became the same as the monarchy, and the discussion about Islamic Sharia was sidelined. Well, the discussion was a Sharia-based constitution. The Sharia-based constitution itself is a terminology that's included in the religious democracy and Velayat-e Faqih. And if there is a monarchy, it is obligated by the constitution to conform with it.
The Constitutional or Guardian Council consists of 12 members, 6 constitutional law experts and 6 experts of Islamic law, with 3 constitutional mandates. 1. Veto power over legislation passed by Parliament or Majlis. 2. Supervising elections. And 3. Approving or disqualifying candidates seeking to run in local parliamentary, presidential or Assembly of Experts elections. To add a 4, the council is also charged with assuring separation of the powers.
The last duty that I can mention is responding to inquiries by the Administrative Justice Court or Sharia-related inquiries by the Guardian Council. This is a significant duty, and I think it is one of the honorable aspects of our constitution, in the sense that any citizen of the Islamic Republic can report a notion that they believe contradicts the Sharia, for example, an enactment by the Board of Ministers or regulations approved by a minister, or the enactments of a city council in an area in a country. If they claim that the matter is in contradiction to the Sharia, they can visit the Administrative Justice Court, and after receiving their complaint, they will send the Sharia contradictions or claims to the Guardian Council, and the 6 jurists in the Guardian Council will review the case.
Mr. Fattahi contributed on a professional level. He is a researcher at the center.
We have different examples. For instance, if there is an old lady in a village in a central province of the country who has made a complaint that a certain enactment by the Board of Ministers is violating her rights, the Guardian Council reviews the case and approves another enactment. And by this enactment, the rights of a single person that have been violated are restored through the Guardian Council's wisdom. I could say that this model of guarding the civil rights of the citizens, which is incorporated in the people inside the country as well, does not exist in any other legal system.
After the constitutional movement, according to one of the principles of the constitution, all the laws that were passed by parliament had to be submitted to a group of 5 top religious scholars for approval. The duty of these 5 scholars had nothing to do with the constitution. The Guardian Council has a more important constitutional role than those scholars, as their responsibility was limited to evaluate the laws against the rules of Sharia or religion. Besides, in comparison to those 5 top scholars, the members of the Guardian Council now are more familiar with the issues that the revolution and the country are faced with. As far as legislative jurisdiction goes, should there be a contradiction between parliamentary legislation and the constitution and or Sharia, the Guardian Council sends proposed laws back to parliament or Majlis. Otherwise, the decision can be carried out. And that was to read out Article 94. Now, since the first legislative period of parliament, differences in outlook were a natural part of the legislation process, because MPs wanted to see their bills go through unscathed, while the Constitutional Council had to keep the pragmatic pious. It did so by matching parliamentary legislation against the Constitution and Sharia. That's primary Islamic regulations. As decisions considered essential by parliamentary majority were rejected, protests grew louder. It was then in the early 1980s that Ayatollah Khomeini authorized parliament to take measures contradicting the Sharia in time of emergency, if an absolute majority of MPs voted for the corresponding decision. However, to also satisfy the Constitutional Council, which he held in sacred esteem, later, on January the 24th, 1982, he made the relevant parliamentary decisions dependent on a two-thirds majority. In this case, the Guardian Council could no longer use its veto. However, later, an expediency council was established to vote in the Constitutional Council's stead when Parliament didn't agree with the latter's vote.
Well, the Guardian Council tries to consider these procedures as much as possible when forming their opinion. So when we put an enactment on the agenda, it's reviewed beforehand by the consultative assemblies, both legal and religious assemblies. They will provide the council with similar cases, reminding the council of how they have passed judgment on similar cases before. Even if you choose to contradict the former ruling in this specific cases, it should be known that the history of that ruling is present. The case is not even presented on our agenda before this report is made. This is a review procedure.
To give you a sense of the importance of the Constitutional Council to the system, Article 93 of the Constitution actually states, "The Majlis shall not be considered valid without the Council of Guardians, except when approving the credentials of the representatives and choosing the six jurists of the Council of Guardians. The clerics of the Council are selected by the leader." Then again, Parliament is also one of the three powers, legislature, executive and judiciary, which explains the emergence of the Expediency Council.
In the process of lawmaking, where does the Expediency Council come in?
If the honourable representatives of the Parliament insist on the notion and they say that it may be in contradiction to the Sharia or the Constitution, but it's now necessary for the country for this enactment to take place, even in a limited form. In such a predicament, the Parliament will insist on the subject and votes on the necessity of the notion in question that despite contradicting the Sharia or the Constitution, it should pass. Then it's conveyed to the Expediency Discernment Council. Here we pass judgment in accordance to the main rulings in the Expediency Discernment Council secondary rulings, and the necessities of governing the country is considered, and they review the case, that is, the enactment is in contradiction to Sharia and the Constitution, but we can approve it for a limited number of years.
Even after the establishment of the Expediency Council and its inclusion in the 1989 Constitution, however, the Guardian Council regularly checked the decisions of Majlis and sent them back to the latter when finding anything contradicting the Sharia or the Constitution. The difference is that Parliament no longer has to follow the recommendations of the Guardian Council unless the Expediency Council decides otherwise.
What laws does the Constitutional Council have greater sensitivity over in approving or disproving?
One of the subjects where the Guardian Council is more sensitive about is the subject of individual rights and the nation's rights, making sure that it is not violated in the rulings. For example, when it comes to ownership rights, an individual's ownership rights are safeguarded in the Constitution. If there's a case where an action must be taken to restore the rights of the individuals, it is taken immediately. There are matters towards which the Guardian Council is sensitive based on both Sharia and the Constitution, and in this regard, complaints are made to the Administrative Justice Court if the enactments violate the Sharia and infringe on individual rights. And according to their judgment, cases are sent for review by the Guardian Council, and the jurists review the enactments based on Sharia rulings. And if they believe that it violates the rights of individuals and is wrong according to Sharia, based on their opinion, the Administrative Justice Court is obliged to nullify the enactments and restore the rights of individuals.
Since even the solution, which was the Expediency Council, could not eliminate the problem arising from the contradiction between the importance of Sharia and the need for modern legislation, Ayatollah Khomeini in January 1988 granted the state or the Islamic Republic of Iran the right to disregard Islamic regulations when taking decisions and passing laws. The principle to follow in doing so was the interest or maslahat of the state order in cancelling Islamic principles, even prayer, fasting, and pilgrimage. To establish what these interests of the state were, an expediency committee was put together. Among the members of this committee were six theologians from the Constitutional or Guardian Council, who could now, as expedients, give their consent to the same parliamentary decision which they had rejected as guardians of the Sharia when sitting on the Constitutional Council. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Approving or disproving legislation is not a matter of personal taste. It's based on factual comparison and interpretation of the Constitution. Article 98 does give the Constitutional Council that right, but an interpretation is deemed valid only if approved by a two-thirds majority. The Constitution is considered the backbone of the Islamic Republic. And the Guardian Council is to ensure governmental organizations don't deviate from that constitution. To do so, the Council's right of opposition is not restricted to the bills approved by Parliament, but also applies to statutes approved by boards of organizations and societies belonging to or affiliated with the state. That's Article 85 for you. The Constitutional Council also exercises its right of opposition to statutory instruments approved by the Cabinet and other executive organs. We're talking decrees of the Cabinet, treaties, and statutes. That's by referring to Article 4 of the Constitution. That states, all civil, penal, economic, administrative, military, and political laws and rules must be based on Islamic criteria. And that this shall be at the discretion of the theologian members of the Constitutional Council.
For example, look at some of the cases regarding foreign currency. In Iran, we have experienced huge fluctuations in currency rates, and sometimes it happens that some individuals are obligated to pay the difference in currency rates without any legal obligations. In such cases where huge sums of money are involved, the Guardian Council prioritizes the rights of individuals and annulled a few examples of such enactments. And then there are other examples, the right to drinking water, for example, which is a basic right of individuals, and therefore it is important to the Guardian Council. And if this right has been violated because of industrial use of a water source in a region, the Council recognizes it as contradictory to Sharia and informs the Administrative Justice Court to nullify the industrial use permit.
Talking of pragmatism by overlooking Sharia law, and seeing as Islam considers itself a religion for all time, I asked how Sharia might blend with modern international law. We're talking of the Council changing constitutional law, or disproving it at times. Perhaps there are times when Sharia law should be touched up a little bit, adapted to the times, because we say Islam is a religion for all times, correct?
We have a series of religious rulings which are based on different interpretations and ijtihads and can change with time and are influenced by location and time. But there are religious and human principles which are constant, such as religious principles like Tawhid, which is constant in religious and Sharia rulings. In the second principle of the Constitution, constant adherence to jurists is recommended to accommodate for the question you made, which is the dynamic nature of Islam and its adaptation to the necessities of a new location and time, and it is preserved and reinforced by constant adherence to ijtihad.
In supervision of elections also, personal likes and dislikes are out of question. Supervision of elections, be they presidential, parliamentary, or council of leadership elections, as well as referenda, is in fact meant to keep bias out of the selection process and rigging away from the ballot boxes, by way of Articles 99 and 118 of the Constitution.
Normally, two series of guarantees are considered in that structure to prevent the entity from losing its independence. The first is a structural guarantee and an institutional guarantee that this institution is not dependent on others, so that this entity is separated from others and is not affected by other institutions and not affected by human resources or its budget. But this is only one side of the matter. Another aspect is that we guarantee this in our legal procedures, that the Guardian Council is a completely independent entity in the electoral process. Exactly in our relevant electoral procedures, such as election law of the Islamic Council and presidential election law, it is approved that members of the Guardian Council are not allowed to participate in these elections. This has been intensified to a point where even relatives of the members and the supervisory network in our country are not allowed to have any affiliations to parties or movements.
In vetting candidates, members of the Constitutional Council should see who genuinely supports the revolution, Islam and justice, and equality between the poor and rich. Among its supervisory rights, the Constitutional Council can cancel some votes in ballot boxes. It can cancel election results in some wards. Now, Iran's Constitutional Council is not totally dissimilar to bodies of such nature elsewhere. To compare to Germany, in both countries, transparency is a qualitative feature of the law as one of the important elements in the realization of legal security. And both Iran's Constitutional Council and the Federal Constitutional Court of Germany monitor the transparency of the law in various aspects. But while the Constitutional Council carries out oversight of the transparency of the law through Sharia's eyes, Germany's Federal Constitutional Court considers that transparency as an introduction to ensure the fundamental rights and freedoms of the individual. How well do our local Sharia-based laws blend with international law? Because a law can create security only if the people understand it's doing so. So perhaps by now we are at least executing the law in a way that it complies with international law?
We follow the political model to ensure that the Constitution and our norms are not violated or affected by our lawmaking processes. We have to guarantee that. To that end, we created a system or mechanism. Our system is similar to the one applied in France, with a number of differences. In terms of members, our system differs from the constitutional system of France. We have 6 religious experts and 6 legal experts. Considering that one of the norms in our legal system is Sharia law, they are considered experts in that field.
While councils and bodies work together, they're also supposed to maintain independence. The Constitutional Council must assure this while vetting candidates for elected positions. That is why I asked why all three powers are more or less uniformly principless since parliamentary elections of 2020 and presidential elections of 2021. One of the main duties of the Constitutional Council is to supervise elections and select candidates. How exactly do you do this?
The Guardian Council sets the law as its main criteria when it comes to evaluating those who register as presidential candidates or parliament candidates. According to the law, any individual who seeks to volunteer for such positions should have a series of qualities. The Guardian Council does not take a political stance on reviewing these individuals and does not consider their affiliations with any parties or movements. The Guardian Council's judgment is based on the law, and as a result, when they look at the last 4 40-something years, you see that the product of these reviews has been different governments with varying perspectives and various political approaches, or different parliaments with different approaches who have taken office. All of this indicates that the Guardian Council does not have a politically influenced orientation in this regard.
Article 57 of the Constitution recognized the independence of branches of government under the leader. The three branches or powers must interact in their legislative, executive, and judicial capacities, but while maintaining their independence. Talking legislature, the Constitutional Council has authority beyond approving or disproving legislation. By way of Article 98, it also has judicial powers, or so goes our media understanding of it.
Do explain the Constitutional Council's judicial duties and authorities going by Article 98.
It does not hold any legal jurisdiction, but when the difference of opinion between the Parliament and the Guardian Council is not resolved and it is brought to the Expediency Discernment Council, it may be subjected to changes or amended in some way. If the law is passed and goes through its relevant procedure to take effect, if someone, for example, the president says that I don't accept this law, or even the head of the judiciary claims that I don't accept this law, or the head of the legislative body disagrees with the enactment, the Guardian Council can form a case in this regard and refer it to the legal authorities that this person is refusing to carry out their duties or is acting against the law or the Constitution.
In talking of power and powers, I recall the saying, power corrupts. How these council individuals selected for knowledge as well as piety are kept honest to the task, I had our guests comment on.
Imam was an architect. He proclaimed the Islamic Republic. Republic pertains to the discussion of the constitution and the presence of people in the government. On the other hand, it is Islamic, preserving the Islamic nature and conforming the behavior of governors to Islam. In the model of the Islamic Republic, the two are codependent. You cannot say that I will implement Islam without the participation of the public, or accept the presence of people in the government without observing the ideological principles of Islam. That was the problem with the constitutional movement. It lost its popularity after a while. It was not a popular constitution because the people were sidelined. It was the Shah, the country, and the absolute rule of the monarchy. So after a while, the constitution faced failure because it lacked the backing of the people. Any rule that is not backed by the people, even if it is good, will diminish. It is a divine matter in the issue of the government. The conformity with Islam and ruling according to Islam became a guarantee that tyranny would not form, because one of the main features of Islam is that it will not allow tyranny to form. The oppressor and the oppressed, because the Quran is against oppression, it will not allow this dynamic to form. And in that sense, it can guarantee the constitution, which is what we call a Sharia-based constitution, which borrows its legitimacy from Islam.
That'll be it for today. Thanks for staying with us. We'll be back at the same times each week with a different topic. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration seems to be leaning toward permitting this carbon bomb, which would mark its campaign commitments to ease off on new oil leases. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Zach Brown and Bill McKibben Writers. This article is published under the heading, "The Biden administration wants to drill on Alaska's North Slope." Stay tuned for more. The bitter end of the fossil fuel era is playing out in one of the world's wildest remaining places. Alaska's North Slope, and it's not pretty. Recently, the U.S. Interior Department released a draft supplemental environmental impact statement on the Willow Project, an oil development on Alaska's North Slope, that Interior says would release as much as 284 million metric tons of carbon dioxide over its 30-year lifetime and perhaps more. The Biden administration seems to be leaning toward permitting this carbon bomb, which would mark its campaign commitments to ease off on new oil leases, and in fact would represent a continuation of Trump-era efforts to drill big in the far northern tundra. Trump, you may recall, made drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge a priority, but after a fierce campaign by Greenwich natives and environmentalists, no big oil companies were willing to bid for leases on that land. Perhaps they were beginning to see the writing on the wall. With the cost of renewables plummeting, it no longer made sense to go to the ends of the world in search of more hydrocarbons. But Alaska's congressional delegation, especially Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, never gave up on expanding.